I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date. Whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the Operating Engineers, Local 139, Madison Firefighters, Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Teamsters, Local 695. Joining us now from the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers, Peter Rickman. Brother, good to have you on the show.
Sly, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I've decided that I oppose the COVID relief plan by Joe Biden, and it was Senator Kennedy from Louisiana that convinced me that this just isn't the right way to go. Listen to these profound words, Peter.
Could you describe this bill?
Well, the bill's $2 trillion. Coming right behind it is another $3 trillion that President Biden wants for green infrastructure. The profligacy is mind-numbing. The motto of the Biden administration seems to be, we can't spend too much. Any fair-minded person knows that that's a very superficial, desultory, almost infantile approach. Either that or the people advising President Biden have an opium habit. I mean, any fool can spend money. The objective is not to spend money. It's not how much you spend. It's what you spend it on. 95% of President Biden's bill is not going to even be spent until 2022 and beyond. This isn't a coronavirus bill. This is a left of Lenin neo-socialist wish list. I mean, it just is.
That's it, Peter. I'm done.
The bad John Kennedy there. Wow.
The bad John Kennedy. Yeah.
You know, at a couple of points in time there, Sly, I feel like he started to really make the case for the Biden governing agenda. You know, he's the $3 trillion for a jobs program. Man, I didn't even realize that. I mean, yeah, he's going to slander and call it, ooh, a scary green energy program. What I heard is, oh, that's $3 trillion going into the most important investments that our country can make in transitioning to a clean energy economy and putting people to work in the jobs of the future. These are, you know, I know from the campaign trail and having served on the DNC platform committee that the Biden plan was for green infrastructure was a jobs plan to put literally millions of people to work in living wage union jobs. I'm tickled that John Kennedy is previewing that for us here. I mean, this is great. I'm very excited about that.
I love his combination of Oxford words, and he did go to Oxford, and then the Mr. Haney Green Acres sound effects affect to his voice. That's a really nice combination.
Well, you know, Sly, there once was a time when you could count on senators, some of the Democratic senators from the South, but not without contradiction, though, of being quite erudite and learned and eloquent with that accent here. Of course, I'm sure they say the same thing about us here in Wisconsin with our nasal.
Well, accent. I love the way you just said Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, I get made fun of sometimes because I really do talk like a real Wisconsinite, for a lot of people in the political world that are, you know, they don't understand what it means to be from Nina. Or
Nina Proud. Like Nina Proud.
Yes, that's right.
So, so how, from your perspective, you know, comparing this, people have been comparing this to the best thing that's happened since either the Great Society or the New Deal. Where would you put this in the scheme of things?
I would put it as vitally important. I mean, this is a survival bill. First of all, it's not a stimulus bill. This is a bill being adopted to stem the bleeding. You know, for any number of Republican bloviators and their allies in the pundit class, you know, in the right-wing media, they have consistently talked about how, you know, the bill is going to spend all this money, and it's coming at a time when the economy is doing great and the stock market is doing well. You know, they just continue to expose themselves for who they are and how they talk about this kind of legislation. You know, Sly, for the vast majority of working people, the economy is still in a pretty rough place. You know, the economy isn't what happens on the top line numbers that get reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, although those can be important. The economy is what happens when you're going to look for a job because you've been out of work for 12 months. The economy is whether you can have the bargaining power at your job right now to get a wage increase. You know, the economy is whether wages are going to go up over time or not. And, you know, the economy is still incredibly soft. Unemployment remains too high. People continue to struggle to pay the rent and pay the electric company bill. They struggle to put food on the table because things aren't going so well. This bill is a survival bill.
Well, even before the pandemic hit a year ago, how far were we into it when the lines started forming for food banks? How long did it take for things to cave in? Was it a week, 2 weeks? About 2 weeks, wasn't it?
I think that's a fair estimation, about 2 weeks, yeah.
So what does that say about our society?
Well, it tells us what folks like you and I already know, and I think most of your listeners know, Sly. You know, work has stopped becoming something that pays sufficiently to provide folks a decent and dignified living. Wages in this country, wages, household income, living standards have been stagnant for decades, even declining for folks in the largest growing share of employment in our economy, the low-wage service sector. And so, you know, it shouldn't surprise anyone. It should shock people, but it shouldn't surprise anyone that 2 weeks into a period of time with massive employment dislocations and wide-scale unemployment that folks were turning to food banks and folks were concerned about being evicted by the end of the month. You know, when we talk about living paycheck to paycheck, that's not just a nice phrase that rolls off the tongue. That is the reality for a lot of people, that if they miss a paycheck, hell, if they miss a day of work because their kid gets sick or they get sick, it can really throw folks for a financial loop. And I think that's one of the greatest arguments that we have for not just adopting this survival bill that the Biden administration put forward and worked on with Chuck Schumer and Bernie Sanders and Nancy Pelosi in Congress, but understanding that this is just to get us to even. So then we can start talking about governing programs that meet the challenges of the 21st century, not just challenges that came up because Donald Trump was a historic disaster, but meeting the challenges because we haven't governed in that sort of way since the Great Society, and in some ways since Reagan, but obviously that was going in the wrong direction. So I look forward to the green energy bill that John Kennedy from Louisiana, the bad John Kennedy, was talking about, because now we can start discussing things like the governing scale necessary to deal with this long-term trend of declining wages, declining household income, declining living standards, since work doesn't pay anymore. So I think this was just like, we had to do this to be able to get to a point where we can have a real discussion about what policies need to be adopted.
This is going to come as a shock to you, so I need you to sit down. But our senior senator and former class ring salesman from Mankato, Minnesota, disagrees. So let's hear what Senator Gopher has to say.
First, I would target to those, you know, 9 million people who've lost their jobs. Now, I realize they should be on unemployment, and they're getting a pretty generous plus up. So how much do they really need as well? So again, I'm not saying this is easy to target, but we ought to try a whole lot harder than what we are, as opposed to just shotgunning out a couple $100 billion more of money when we don't have it. We don't have an unlimited checking account.
We don't have an unlimited checking account. Well, it seems to me, Mr. Rickman, that in 2017, Ron Johnson felt we did have an unlimited checking account to give Amazon and Facebook and Exxon great big tax cuts. As a matter of fact, some of those tax cuts actually encouraged businesses to leave the country. Mr. Rickman, what say you?
Well, I think it's an interesting mirror here that Republicans made it their top legislative priority under the Trump administration. Supposedly this, you know, populist presidential candidate nominee and then elected president who is going to shift the Republican Party to being a party of the working class. It's interesting that they made their top priority a $1.9 trillion tax cut for corporations and the rich that continued to accelerate Republican governance from the past 30, 40 years. Unfortunately, a Republican governance, I might add, that has been joined in by Democrats from time to time without, respect for the American working class. But I digress here. Republicans made their top priority in the Trump era a $1.9 trillion tax cut for corporations and the rich. And it had exactly the effect intended, to put more money in the pockets of the 1% and Wall Street, the billionaire class and the boss class, and did literally nothing to lift the economic fortunes of the working class. Now, because of the absolute disaster of the Trump presidency, capped by this failure to confront the global pandemic and in failing to do so, wreaking this economic damage that the working class in this country could ill afford, the Biden administration had to prioritize at the front end a survival package. It happened to be $1.9 trillion. That's a nice coincidence, though. But it shows you what the priorities are of the Republicans under Trump and who continue to remain in office, like their chief enabler, Ron Johnson, versus what happens when you put even the most moderate of Democrats in charge in Joe Biden. Although, you know, I think boosted by the chairmanship of the budget committee that put together this package, led by Bernard Sanders, independent of Vermont.
Bernard, I like that. That's what his brother calls him. All right. So here is Congressman Tim Ryan from Youngstown, Ohio, the Youngstown area, talking on the floor of the House the other day.
Mr. Speaker, one of the earlier speakers said, this is the most dramatic change in labor law in 80 years. And I say, thank God. In the late 70s, a CEO made 35 times the worker. Today, it's 300 to 400 times the worker. And our friends on the other side, running around with their hair on fire. Heaven forbid we pass something that's going to help the damn workers in the United States of America. Heaven forbid we tilt the balance that has been going in the wrong direction for 50 years. We talk about pensions, you complain. We talk about the minimum wage increase, you complain. We talk about giving them the right to organize, you complain. But if we were passing a tax cut here, you'd be all getting in line to vote yes for it. Now stop talking about Dr. Seuss and start working with us on behalf of the American workers.
That's one of the best things I've heard in a long time.
That was a pretty dang good one there, Sly. You know, I would really, I hope what this intro piece, the clip that you played, was for us to start talking about Dr. Seuss and cancel culture. That's really what I'm here for, Sly. I'm not here to talk about, you know, fiery populism on the floor of the House of Representatives.
You want to talk about Mr. Potato Head's genitalia?
I think you mean Potato Head, Sly. I have to say, because, you know, there are family and friends of mine, from around our fine states who are, you know, leaning hard in some cases to the right side of the political spectrum, that posted on Facebook a couple times about this Potato Head and Dr. Seuss business. I had to familiarize myself with these alleged controversies and what cancel culture is, the term the right wing has started to use.
Well, it's interesting. They didn't call it that. It was just the 17th anniversary of poor Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks getting canceled. They didn't call it cancel culture then.
I mean, this is such a great microcosm. I had to familiarize myself with these things because they were being talked about. And this is what Fox News and the right is talking about. They're talking about Mr. Potato Head doll. They're talking about Dr. Seuss's estate taking books off the market. Books, by the way, that none of these people have ever bought, much less read. And they're not talking about things like, what are we going to do to beat the pandemic? They're not talking about things like, what are we going to do to actually shift the fortunes of the American working class? You know, they put out these distractions. And of course, they wrap it up with this nice little label, cancel culture, or whatever the heck it is. So that, you know, they can make it as if they're the aggrieved party here.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, because obviously some people feel threatened by that. By the way, Democrats didn't really have any involvement with either of those two controversies.
Right, right.
So I don't really think that Joe Biden's worried about Mr. Potato Head at this point. But for the people that do, I'm not talking about the full-on Trumpers, but for the people that this sort of annoys, and they kind of latch on to it, and they don't really think that politicians are ever really going to fix the fact that there are no jobs in southeastern Kentucky, and they don't really think anything's ever going to get any better in West Virginia. How do we dispel them that they're wrong, that there can be a better way?
Well, I think, you know, aside from going and playing on every radio and TV station in those parts of the country and across northern Wisconsin and the whole swath of Wisconsin, in fact, you know, that if we can't just go and play that Tim Ryan clip, then we need to have political leaders who follow the lead of someone like Tim Ryan and what he's talking about. You know, I don't recall hearing a great deal of Democratic Party candidates and officials giving nearly as impassioned and informed a speech about delivering for the American working class by balancing the power between bosses and workers is what he did there. You know, I think if the Biden administration and the Democratic House and Senate majorities take up things like adoption of the PRO Act, a pretty strong labor law reform here to balance the power between the boss class and the working class, and banged away at that and banged away on things like raising the minimum wage and banged away on expanding health care, I think we could start to, over time, there's no silver bullet slide, there's no immediate solution, we could start to, over time, chip away at this idea that governance and politics will not deliver for working people. I think the folks who don't think politicians are going to do anything about their jobs or about wages or economic standards are necessarily wrong, because I think all they've seen is that politicians make it worse. They don't hear a lot about folks.
No, I guess what I feel as though where they're wrong is that they'll, you know, just vote with their worst instincts, and that somehow their dreams are going to come true because they've bought into a politician that's pandering to those worst fears. We'll take a break here. Peter Rickman with us from the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers at SlysOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
The attorneys at Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com.
We're back at SlysOffice.com. Peter Rickman with us from Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers. We're talking about jobs, minimum wage. I do want to touch on the minimum wage because that's obviously a crucial issue. What do you make of these arguments that it's a lot more expensive to live in New York than it is in Charleston, West Virginia, and small businesses shouldn't have to pay the same wages in West Virginia that they do New York?
Well, I don't think anybody with half a brain is going to argue that it does cost more to live in New York or it does cost more to live in Chicago than it does to live in Charleston or live in, you know, Rhinelander, Wisconsin, a hoedown country. But, you know, the truth is, Sly, we need to bring up the minimum to be enough to live in Charleston or in Rhinelander. Every job deserves a living wage. All labor has dignity. So, yeah, we should be bringing that up to at least a down payment on a living wage for anyone that punches the clock to bring home a paycheck. That's at least 15. By the way, so I don't know if you know this, but if minimum wage kept pace with productivity gains, that's what we, the working class, do to grow the economy, it would be in the mid-20s per hour. So 15 is just a down payment.
What would it be had there been a mechanism? And I even heard Senator Manchin mention this the other day, that we have mechanisms to index Social Security for inflation, that we should be doing the same with the minimum wage. What would the minimum wage be if it had properly been raised adjusted for inflation over the years, rather than, especially during the Reagan years, being stagnant. I don't know. I guess the minimum wage might have gone up once during Clinton and once during Bush, but it hasn't gone up very much.
Yeah, well, the simple answer to this, let me say, Sly, once the minimum wage gets corrected more for what it should be, which is to ensure that anyone that is working a job brings home a paycheck sufficient to support themselves and a life of decency and dignity. Once we correct for that, then yeah, we should adjust it for inflation. But simply having the minimum wage pegged to inflation as compared to, you know, what it was in 1968 or in 1986 or something like that isn't going to get us what we need, because we can't just have a minimum wage that, you know, keeps pace with inflation but always remains below that level of sufficiency. You cannot make an argument to me, Sly. There's not a single person that can. And I think most of your listeners would be in the same boat as me here. You can't make an argument to me that there shouldn't be a government-guaranteed right to bring home a living wage. There's no excuse for a business getting away with paying workers less than a living wage. That's Franklin Roosevelt right there, brother. When he worked on adopting the first minimum wage law, by the way, it was finally adopted June 25th, 1938. Part of the rhetoric that he used was that no working person should be bringing home less than a living wage. No business should be paying anyone less than a living wage. In fact, that business doesn't have a right to exist. And I'll tell you what, Sly, it is the height of entitled thinking to believe that anyone has this alleged, a right to operate a business that requires the workers to make poverty wages and subsidize that business's existence. That has no place in a democratic and decent society. This is the richest country in the history of the world, Sly. Tell me we can't pay people living wages.
What about some of the other things that have sort of connected with the minimum wage, but employers get around it? We're talking about tipped workers. We're talking about, heck, there's even a debate now for musicians, because they can't really go out and sell CDs the way they used to, on how they're getting ripped off by Spotify, and that we need to have some standards for musicians. You know, who thinks about that, right? What about all these ancillary things that go along with lifting people up? And the whole gig economy, the whole Uber Lyft thing.
I mean, you're treading into some broad territory here, brother. I think that...
Well, these are all things we have to deal with now, because these are all realities now for people's lives.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we got to set the minimum floor. We got to set the floor such that it is getting closer to a living wage. I keep saying that's why I think, you know, a living wage, $15 an hour minimum wage, if you work full time, translates to a little bit over $31,000 per year. And that's still less than what it takes to live a decent and dignified life for a single person, much less someone who's part of a family. You know, we need to get everyone raised up even further. So 15 is a down payment, but we set the floor at that. We need to, as you noted, index it to inflation so it continues to grow. I'd love to index it to productivity gains. I'd love to index it to things like the increase in CEO pay or the increase in corporate profits. By the way, if minimum wage had kept pace with that, we'd be talking about something in the $30 per hour range. Now we're getting somewhere. You know, we need to eliminate this racist, misogynistic relic of the past that is the tipped minimum wage, $2.33 an hour in Wisconsin, $2.13 federally. I mean, it's just outrageous. We need to get rid of things like the racist and misogynist exclusion of agricultural and domestic workers. I mean, there was this fiction invented in the 1930s when a bunch of our labor and employment and social welfare policies were adopted to keep black folks and women out of the formal labor market. So agricultural and domestic workers were excluded from things like Fair Labor Standards Act, coverage minimum wage, labor rights under the Wagner Act, that's the National Labor Relations Act, federal labor law, Social Security, et cetera. So we need to end, you know, these 85-year-old exclusions that unfortunately have been baked into the cake for far too long. We also need to, and I think Slide just gets to the point that you're drawing out here, we need to reinvent our labor and employment standards for a 21st century economy. Let me paint a picture for you here. In 1935, when the height of the second New Deal was playing out and a great deal of our labor and employment laws were created. They had developed for the past 20 years around an industrial economy and a social structure that, you know, had sort of hardened over the 40 years previous. But those laws, those policies were adopted closer to the dawn of the Civil War than what they were to today. The idea that we are living in a policy world for an economy that has long since ceased to exist and was crafted in the wake of the Civil War giving rise to the industrial era is just bonkers. It's utterly foolish. And so we need to adopt a labor and employment law and policy regime for the 21st century that deals with the gig economy.
Is there a country that's effectively done this?
Well, I think the irony here, Sly, is in the wake of World War II, when the United States and the Soviet Union liberated Europe from the clutches of the, you know, fascism, in the wake of that, there was, unfortunately, a competition between those two great powers. And what it meant with the Marshall Plan that the United States put forward and the rebuild of the Western European, Southern European, and Nordic European countries was that they were able to craft their own version of labor and employment laws around what the economy looked like at that point in time. And they did things in a more universalist way, which meant that it wasn't just oriented around an industrial economy that was very specific to how you make things work with a given enterprise and a given set of workers. They made their law and policy, their social policies and their labor laws and employment standards rooted in coverage of everyone. So they've been able to adapt and adopt based upon the changes in the economy. No, nobody's perfect, but, you know, for example, yeah, I think for some people in my world, the trope of McDonald's workers in Denmark is a relatively good one to look at. The folks there have full health care coverage and a pension. They have actual rights on the job. They're covered by a union contract that covers everybody in that fast food industry. It's not just based upon one McDonald's worksite or even one employer that is McDonald's. They make something on the order of $20 to $25 per hour in wages. So they've been able to work with a labor and employment law regime that has adapted to the rise of the 21st century service sector economy. Now, is it perfect there? No. By no means. Every place has to reform and change and evolve over time. But I think the greatest, you know, lesson here for us, Sly, is that the United States has, as Tim Ryan noted, not updated its labor and employment standards and its policy structure for generations.
So before we go today, I want to briefly ask you about what's going on with the nurses in Madison. Let me play a clip from a story from NBC 15.
Well, the nurses' bargaining unit has been negotiating for the last month for nearly 15 hours at a time, and they're demanding a fair and safe work environment. So here's what they're asking for. Nurses say they want a wage increase to reflect the sacrifices they made in the last year. They're asking for incentive pay when working on their off days. PTO and sick days were also a demand. Nurses say they need more time off to achieve work-life balance.
All right. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, you know, and I should say I'm somewhat close to the situation here, and I've been.
That's why I asked you.
Yeah. Well, the truth is, we've always known, Sly, that nurses are heroes. For decades, they've been the most trusted profession in America, and nurses have always sacrificed for the greater good, the common good, the decency of the healthcare system, and particularly their patients. And over the last year, they've truly been the heroes that we've needed, not just on the front lines of beating the pandemic, but literally our last line of defense against this public health crisis. We all owe nurses a debt of gratitude. But for too long, nurses have put up with too much, not just during the pandemic, but years before that. And in Madison, the nurses at Meritor Hospital there, that the clip has been played on, they deserve a fair contract that takes care of what they need. And yes, it's fair wages, but it's really about ensuring that their jobs are dignified and respected, that their work is appreciated, and that they have what they need to be successful. And the fact that their employer is refusing to do so speaks really to the character of the health industry today. It's not just about Meritor Hospital. It's about all the hospitals. You know, we need to ensure that these Meritor nurses get what they need in this contract bargaining and potential, you know, unrest that is going on there. And God love those nurses, man. They are standing up for themselves. 98% of them voted to give their bargaining committee the authority to issue a 10-day notice to strike. And by the way, that's not – they didn't vote to strike. They voted to put in place the pieces they need to if that becomes necessary because of what happens at the bargaining table. But if you look at if you look at the whole of Madison, Sly, you know, the nurses at UW Hospital and Clinic Authority had their unions stripped away in 2014. And they've been organizing to win that union back because they know that only when the power is balanced between bosses and workers are they going to get what they need. And I think what's going on at Meritor is showing the nurses of UW Hospital and Clinic Authority, who've already said with a clear, strong majority, we want a union. And they're showing the nurses at St. Mary's Hospital there. And frankly, they're showing the nurses across Wisconsin that when folks have a voice and a seat at the table, they can in fact struggle for and fight for and win what they need. So this is a pretty important, you know, labor struggle here. If we've looked back at the last 12 months, one thing we've learned is that we need to do better by our nurses and our frontline healthcare workers. The nurses at Meritor are leading the way to show folks what's possible through a union and collective action that, you know, when they're stronger together and the power is balanced between bosses and workers, they can fight for it and get what they need. So I, for one, believe that this is the launch to something that can take Madison hospitals and nurses by storm. And you could imagine a world where every nurse in Madison, every healthcare worker in Madison is part of a strong, powerful democratic trade union that ensures that not only are the dignity, rights, and respect that all workers deserve that affected on the job, but that because of a powerful healthcare worker voice, patient care and public health are protected from the folks.
Well, I was just going to say, isn't there a direct benefit for the consumer, the patient?
You know, I think that anytime you're leaving the decisions about public health and patient care in the hands of accountants and bureaucrats who are looking out for the bottom line, you're going to skimp. You know, that's why our healthcare system in this country is the most expensive of any in the world, but delivers patient care outcomes that are middling at best because we got too many profit makers. We got too many accountants and bureaucrats calling the shots, looking out for money coming in the door instead of looking out for patient care and public health. I'd rather have a nurse. I'd rather have a CNA. I'd rather have the folks who know what it's like on the front lines of patient care and public health defense having a voice in that. I'm not saying that the nurses are going to run the hospital. I'm not saying the CNAs are going to run the nursing home. What I'm saying is we need their voices in this because they know the most about it and they're the most dedicated to patient care and public health outcomes. So whether it's dietary and housekeeping workers in a hospital or nursing home, whether it's the CNAs or nurses, the lab techs, et cetera, you know, we need to ensure that healthcare workers have more power in the workplace and in that healthcare industry, because only when they are empowered are we going to see the kind of healthcare system that we all deserve here. Now, that's just a start. Obviously, there's a lot to do, like guaranteeing healthcare by right, single payer, universal healthcare for everybody. But I think if we can work to support these nurses who are on the front lines in the fight for, you know, the public health and patient care we need, and the jobs that every working person deserves with dignity, rights, and respect, you know, we can make some real gains here for the democratic and decent society all of us working class people deserve.
Peter Rickman, Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers, thanks for coming to Sly's office.
Always a pleasure, Sly. Thanks for having me.
Sly'sOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.